This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week, Republicans in the state legislature passed a series of bills limiting the power of the state's governor and attorney general in an extraordinary session. Governor Walker has yet to sign those bills, but has indicated support in general. Democrats and even a few Republicans are pressuring Walker to veto the legislation. Governor-elect Tony Evers has requested a meeting to talk about the bills. He said that if they are signed into law, his administration will consider taking measures to court. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it's been a long week, especially for state capitol reporters like you, Laurel. What are the latest developments that you're keeping an eye on Friday now?
So the things that we're keeping an eye on today are primarily, you know, when is Governor Walker going to sign this legislation? If he is going to sign it, if he's going to veto any of it, and just kind of the continued debate surrounding that that signing. As you mentioned, you know, Governor-elect Evers is reaching out to Governor Walker, encouraging him to not sign the legislation, to veto it entirely, as are a number of other groups. And we're also keeping an eye on those lawsuits that you mentioned, you know, who might be filing suit against what part of these extraordinary session bills. I mean, there was quite a bit in there. So there are a number of things that could end up in court next year.
And today we've seen the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau put out their analysis of the bills passed by lawmakers. Now, usually they do this in the midst of the legislative process, and then lawmakers look at their cost estimates and things like that as they consider the legislation. Why are we seeing this one after the votes are already cast?
Well, you know, this legislation moved pretty quickly. It's not unheard of for bills to move through the state legislature pretty fast in certain instances, but I think that was a common refrain that we heard from particularly Democratic lawmakers during the debate, in the wee hours of Wednesday morning was they hadn't gotten these documents yet, and they had a lot of questions and wanted some more sort of plain language explanations of what's in the bills and also the fiscal implications of the bills. So we have gotten those sort of after the fact. And we've been able to identify some things that weren't really focused on during the debate or during the lead up to these bills making it to the floor. So they've certainly been interesting documents to look through now that all the bills are on Governor Walker's desk.
Now, one item that we haven't talked about on Central Time, it kind of got buried by all the specific measures. Also this week, votes to confirm some of Governor Walker's appointments. 82 of them. Do I have that right?
That's right. 82 appointments. So this was something that happened pretty early on Tuesday. It was kind of the first thing that the Senate took up when they went to the floor. And a lot of these appointments are for things that people probably aren't familiar with, you know, things like the Wisconsin Health and Educational Facilities Authority or the Dentistry Examining Board, the Medical Examining Board, things like that. But the ones that really stuck out to us as reporters, there was an appointment to the Public Service Commission. That's the body that approves rate hikes for utilities, things like that. Ellen Nowak, who had previously been a commissioner and then moved over to be Governor Walker's secretary in the Department of Administration, he reappointed her back to the PSC now that he's leaving. And the governor also appointed Scott Bechtel to the University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents to replace outgoing Regent Brian Steil, who's of course now going to be the representative replacing Congressman Paul Ryan in the 1st Congressional District. So those are kind of a couple big ones. And I think not just their visibility or their high profile, but those are also appointments that are going to last potentially after Governor-elect Evers leaves office. These are appointments that go through 2023. So if Governor-elect Evers doesn't run for another term or doesn't win another term after this current one, these folks will still be in these positions appointed by Governor Walker.
Are people raising these appointments as part of a theme of establishing things that Governor-elect Evers can't do when he takes office?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big theme of the extraordinary session, was sort of doing things to either protect Republican legislative accomplishments, things that they thought were particularly important or meaningful, from interference by Governor-elect Evers when he takes office, or sort of getting some things done so they couldn't be done by the governor-elect when he takes office in January.
What's been the tone since that overnight session? Are we hearing any efforts at conciliation from either party saying, okay, we've got this behind us now, maybe we can find ways to work together?
You know, that's been a message from, I think, both sides throughout this process. When there was the first sort of inklings of conversation of potentially limits on Governor-elect Evers' powers, they were very vague. We didn't know what was going on. Evers said, I'm going to wait and see, kind of, you know, in good faith, see what lawmakers are discussing before I weigh in on this. And legislative leaders, even during debate on Tuesday and Wednesday, said, you know, we understand that we're going to have to work with Governor-elect Evers. We just want to put these measures into place so we feel like we're on an equal playing field and he doesn't have an undue amount of power when he takes office. So I think that conversation of working together in a bipartisan manner has been happening since the beginning. What that actually looks like in practice, we're going to have to wait and see until January.
And on the other hand, we've heard things from the leaders, Voss and Fitzgerald. This guy's really liberal and we're really worried that he's going to, you know, upset our agenda. So some conciliation talk, but definitely some partisan talk in this process as well.
Absolutely. They've, you know, Senator Fitzgerald said that he doesn't trust Governor-elect Evers, and he does believe that he has some pretty liberal policies. And both of the legislative leaders have said they're concerned about those policies being enacted and some of their accomplishments being taken away, the things that they've been able to do over the past 8 years with Governor Walker.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about bills passed this week during an extraordinary session of the legislature. They're now waiting for Governor Walker's signature, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your take on this? Do you think Governor Walker should veto any or all of these pieces of legislation? Do you think he will? What do you want to see from Governor-elect Evers when he comes into office? Do you see room for cooperation after this rocky start, even before Inauguration Day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the extraordinary session of the legislature this week and the bills now on Governor Walker's desk that would limit some powers of Governor-elect Tony Evers and incoming Attorney General Josh Call. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. Cindy is with us in Germantown. Cindy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Cindy?
I think it's wrong for the Republicans to try to control an office, well, actually both offices of Josh Call and Tony Evers. They were voted out of positions of Attorney General and Governor. I mean, the Republicans were voted out, so they need to let the Democrats elect Tony Evers and Josh Call do their job. And I would also like to see the incoming governor-elect Tony Evers expand Medicaid that was offered under the ACA, and I'd also like to see him withdraw from the lawsuit as well to get rid of ACA.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. And Laurel, these new laws make it harder for Governor-elect Evers to do both of those things Cindy just mentioned, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's absolutely the case. So under current law, the state attorney general would be able to remove the state from lawsuits like the one pending against the ACA with gubernatorial approval. The new extraordinary session bills that passed this week shift that from gubernatorial approval to legislative approval, and particularly for the state budget committee, or specifically the state budget committee. And that committee is currently has a 12-4 majority with Republicans to Democrats. So it's very, very unlikely that they would approve such a move by Attorney General Call.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We'll go next to Joe in Princeton. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, before the election, Walker said he was going to call a special session after the election to consider the $100 million bailout of Kimberly Clark. He didn't want to do it before the election. And now, in the special session, it was never brought up at all, and I can't figure out why not. Why was it never discussed even? And there was certainly no bill. And do you know what happened to that?
Joe, thanks. Laurel, what happened to the Kimberly Clark incentive package?
So the Kimberly-Clark incentive package passed the state assembly in February, I believe, so pretty quickly after the governor introduced it. The issue always with that package and why it was discussed for a special session or an extraordinary session after the election was the state Senate. It just had to get through the Senate before it could go to Governor Walker for his signature. And that was part of the back and forth leading up to this extraordinary session. We talked to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald multiple times to see how negotiations were going in the Senate, if he could get more senators on board to get it to pass now versus, you know, before the election. And it continued to be a problem for him. He told us just a couple days before the session that he only had, I believe, 11 senators on board. And of course, you need several more than that to pass legislation in the Senate. So basically what it came down to is it didn't come to the floor because Republicans weren't able to get enough support within their own party. And Democrats said that there wasn't enough work done by Republicans to get them to come on board, to get them to vote for it and make it bipartisan. So basically, it just didn't have enough support in the state Senate to pass. Now, Governor Walker did tweet today, and he said that he's going to look into ways without the legislature to offer some form of incentive to Kimberly-Clark. That would probably be through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which wouldn't require legislative approval. So we'll have to keep an eye on that in the coming weeks.
And on the list of things we're keeping an eye on, of course, is Governor Walker signing all these new pieces of legislation from the extraordinary session. Has he given us clues as to whether or not he's going to sign these?
He hasn't. We talked to him before the session when we just had a general idea about these bills. And a few specific things that would be included. And he indicated that he was fairly open to considering signing. There have been a number of individuals and groups that have come out since the package passed the legislature urging the governor not to sign. So it'll be interesting how he weighs that input going forward versus the arguments that are coming from the legislative leaders in the legislature.
And we've gotten hints from the governor-elect. It looks like that, at least for some of these pieces of legislation, if they are signed, lawsuits are on the way.
Absolutely. So I actually spoke to one Wisconsin Institute, which challenged the state on a variety of voting-related laws and won a federal lawsuit in 2016 on those laws. And they said that they're working already to try to identify what a lawsuit would look like for them going forward, particularly as it relates to early voting restrictions that were passed in this package of legislation. There are others that are also talking about lawsuits that have to do with the separation of powers. So, arguing that lawmakers really overstepped their bounds in prescribing the duties of the attorney general or the governor in this legislative package. So it's going to be interesting what lawsuits come out in the coming weeks, months, year ahead, and what those arguments are.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us again and all the work you've done this week and every other week. But this has been a big week.
It's been a big week. It's my pleasure to join you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter with us to talk about the latest in the ongoing story of bills coming out of this extraordinary session of the legislature this week. They are waiting for Governor Walker's signature now. The 2018 Farm Bill has been stalled in Congress for months now, and with the lame duck session in Washington coming to a close, lawmakers are working to bring a revised version of the bill up for a vote before the end of the month. Talking to WZAW-TV this week, Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin said the bill is critical for farmers in Wisconsin.
Our dairy farmers are in crisis, and this bill can't pass soon enough, in my opinion, to provide new tools for them.
Catherine Boudreau is a food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into the current state of the legislation, can you give us a sense of what all is included in the Farm Bill? Because it's a lot.
Yes, it's an enormous bill, and it costs about $860 billion over a decade. And the largest part of the bill is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Represents about 70% of the bill, and that's, of course, formerly known as food stamps. And then it also covers crop subsidies for farmers, conservation, rural development, agricultural research, and also some investment in trade promotion.
So let's dig into some of those pieces of the puzzle here. First of all, food stamps or food assistance. What has been the state of negotiation in both chambers of Congress?
Yeah, so this is one of the biggest hurdles for Farm Bill negotiators because the House version that passed earlier this summer passed on strictly partisan lines, so it was only voted for by Republicans. And that's because Democrats were largely opposed to the plan of imposing stricter work requirements on millions of our participants and also tightening some eligibility criteria and then reinvesting some of the savings from that into mandatory state education and training programs. The idea was, you know, the economy is growing, the unemployment rate is lowering, so House Republicans argued that it was time to invest in work training so that more people would be joining the workforce. But there was a lot of concerns from Democrats about whether, potentially reducing a significant amount of benefits for participants, but also just the feasibility of states to stand up these mandatory work and training programs. I think they would have had to quadruple in size within the next few years, which there was a lot of concerns about whether the states would be able to do that. So what we've ended up with, because House and Senate agriculture lawmakers have agreed, they have reached an agreement, but what we end up with is a version that looks much more like the Senate, which really didn't touch eligibility or reduce benefits and mostly just remains like the status quo of SNAP.
And you and your colleagues have reported that the White House might throw a little extra something in here to make some of those House Republicans happy. What are they looking at doing?
That's right. So the USDA is looking at tightening what's known as SNAP waivers. And basically what this does is allow states to waive work requirements for this population known as able-bodied adults without dependents. They're limited to receiving benefits for 3 months within 3 years unless they're working or participating in job training programs. But House Republicans argue that states are abusing the process, so is the White House, so they're looking at trying to limit their ability to do that.
And so Republicans are saying states are abusing this power. States might look and say, hey, wait, you're looking to restrict our flexibility when it comes to food aid.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So I think the USDA hasn't proposed its rule yet. I think it's right now it's waiting at the White House Office of Management and Budget that has to review regulations. So we haven't seen the proposal yet. So I don't know the specifics, but Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue has said it's coming shortly.
We're talking to Catherine Boudreau from Politico Pro. She's a food and agriculture reporter there. We're looking at the latest on the U.S. Farm Bill, negotiations between key members of the Senate and the U.S. House to try to pull this together. Catherine, let's get into milk and dairy farming, a big issue here in Wisconsin. A lot of concerns among dairy farmers about sustained low prices for commodity milk. What kind of things are we seeing in the Farm Bill when it comes to dairy?
Yeah, so the final Farm Bill is expected to basically expand protection for dairy farmers, build on what is already in current law, and that they're going to make it more affordable for dairy farmers to purchase higher coverage levels. So coverage, you know, protection from low milk prices. So when milk prices drop, they'll be able to receive like a, you know, so-called indemnity from the government. And House Agriculture Ranking Member Colin Peterson, I think this week in interviews, has been saying that basically it's kind of, you know, dairy farmers wouldn't be able to get, they would receive assistance if anything was low, if prices were anything lower than break even, especially for the smaller dairy farmers, like under, you know, 240 cows or so. So that's what I'm hearing.
And this is what I think they call in the business a counter-cyclical, meaning in the cycle when prices go low for whatever commodity, that's when assistance kicks in, as opposed to just regular across-the-board constant subsidies. So that's a different approach.
That is right. So farm policy has evolved over the years. Now agriculture policymakers, farmers and ranchers, they tend to advocate for a more market-based approach instead of just sending subsidies regardless of prices or the market trends. So the margin protection program, as it's called, for dairy producers, it's based on when the difference between milk prices and feed prices drop below a certain level. So farmers can insure against low margins.
Another part of the Farm Bill has over the years involved conservation and land stewardship, including a conservation stewardship program, I think that's what it's called. Environmentalists, hunters, and others kind of watch this kind of thing. What are we seeing on that in these negotiations?
Right. So their conservation programs are about $5 billion a year. And so it's not a huge portion of the Farm Bill, but still a significant part. And you're right that this is important to conservationists and a lot of the agricultural lawmakers here in Washington. And basically, there was a difference of opinion about this program called conservation stewardship. And I would say that was the biggest difference between the two bills. But what we'll see is that it remains intact. And this is a program that pays farmers to implement practices that improve soil quality, water quality, air quality, and it will be reduced in funding, I'm pretty sure. So, but some of that money will be, some of the savings will be put back into other conservation initiatives because there's a number of them in the Farm Bill. But that program will remain intact, just probably at a decreased funding level.
Now, in the agriculture world, there have been a lot of questions and concerns about tariff wars between the U.S. and other countries, soybean farmers in particular, but not just soybean farmers, being hit by tariffs from other countries. Does the Farm Bill tackle tariff issues and tariff relief, or is that seen as a separate issue?
So it is a separate issue. The Farm Bill, what it has for trade is a lot of these promotional programs in that the government invests money and then the industry invests, you know, some money, and then they use that, they combine forces to go promote commodities overseas to kind of build markets and demand for exports. But so the trade mitigation package that the Trump administration announced earlier this year, which is they've allocated about $12 billion, that is a totally separate program, though it's funded by this kind of obscure agency called the Commodity Credit Corporation, and a lot of funding for Farm Bill programs also comes out of that account. But they are two separate things.
Now, an issue that's being watched here in Wisconsin and elsewhere is industrial hemp. I believe there are some pilot programs that allowed states to buy in and say, yeah, we're going to try legalizing industrial hemp. What is the new Farm Bill looking at?
Yeah, this is a priority of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky. He's been a big part of this push to remove hemp from the federal list of controlled substances. So that basically means that if the Farm Bill passes, it'll be legalized and farmers can grow it commercially and sell it on the market. But you're right, there in the 2014 Farm Bill, there was a pilot, so if a state had legalized hemp cultivation, they could do research, they could import it for research, and that would be perfectly legal. But Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, of course, wants it to be legal at the federal level so that there isn't, you know, obstacles to expanding the market.
We covered a lot of ground here already. Any other key issues that have been sticking points along the way?
I think one sticking point was on limiting subsidies to wealthier farmers and ranchers. That's just kind of a debate that's going on in every Farm Bill. Senator Chuck Grassley was interested in limiting the number of managers that farms can have and qualify for subsidies, but ultimately that provision has been dropped, that's my understanding. There was also an attempt by the Senate to lower the adjusted gross income that you can qualify for subsidies from $900,000 a year to $700,000 a year, but ultimately that it's going to remain current law. So if you're a farmer and you earn above $900,000 a year in adjusted gross income, you won't be able to receive commodity subsidies. Now, of course, that test is separate from the crop insurance program. The crop insurance program is not means tested.
All right, all that stuff is on the table. Let's talk about the process now. Congress also has a spending bill to pass. What's the timeline then, given they've got other stuff on their docket for getting this Farm Bill passed?
I think I'm pretty confident that they're going to do this next week. So I think on we'll see a bill introduced very early next week. It'll become public, and we can all dive in and analyze the details. And then I think the House will take it up first, and then when they pass it, and I believe it'll be a bipartisan vote, It'll be sent to the Senate the same week, and then probably sent to President Trump's desk. At this point, I see an easy pathway. I know that there were some questions about whether President Donald Trump would sign it because it doesn't include those stricter work requirements in the SNAP program, but lawmakers have told reporters that they have every indication that the president will sign it, especially due to, I think, the trade uncertainty. I don't think that the president wants to take a risk of not signing a farm bill during times of retaliatory tariffs that are cutting into their bottom lines.
All right, we'll watch for that over the next week. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Catherine Boudreau. She's a food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. She was with us to give us the latest on the farm bill rewrite. Lawmakers are looking to bring that to a vote, as we heard, before the end of this month, maybe as soon as next week.